From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour. I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Dean Haglund, welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and your art show.
Come over here, Phil Lairness. There's someone else you should meet while we're doing this podcast.
Yeah.
In my art show, he got us the high school for the Lady Killers.
This is Leonard.
Yes.
I know Leonard.
Did you meet him?
Leonard, I met at, I met Leonard at the Truth Is Out There screening maybe years ago, didn't I?
Yeah,
did
you're you, supposed yeah. to put my name in the credits.
Yeah.
Your name wasn't in the credits and the Truth Is Out There?
No, for the Lady Killers. For the Lady Killers. Yeah.
What is this thing?
I'm recording. We're doing a podcast. We don't go anywhere without podcasting.
Flash Gordon, you know, Ming the Merciless.
Oh, yeah, that's the taser.
It's Ming a taser, yeah. Sure. So how do you feel? How does it feel to have it all up and
really
to see
exciting,
it?
Really exciting, right? Yeah. I haven't actually looked at it because I've just been nonstop with the selling of the books and getting this PayPal Bluetooth reader operate.
All right. Well, we'll check in with you. I think tomorrow we might be going to Forest Lawn.
Did you talk to John about that?
I didn't. Yeah, John. Every time I turn on the recorder, John gets nervous. So
does he really?
Yeah,
because it looks like a taser.
Shrinking violet. You know that he is.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, we will confer about how the show goes.
Yes.
When we go to Forest Lawn.
I cannot wait.
All right.
And we're connected. And
I'm standing here in the Fine Arts Building, speaking amiably.
Yes.
May we say, with Steve Benequist.
Hello.
Steve, welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour and to Dean Haglund's solo gallery show.
Yes, a fine reason for us to be gathering here. It's really exciting to see his excellent art in this beautiful setting.
You, of course, produced with Dean for quite a while a stand-up show downtown here in Los Angeles.
The Big and Tall Show.
The Big and Tall Show. You were one half of The Big and Tall.
I actually started it, and I was fortunate enough to have him join me in the second year.
So wait a minute. It was called Big and Tall in the first year?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, so it literally is not that one of you is big and one of you is tall.
No.
Oh, all right. Now I'm just... See, now I've seen the man behind the curtain. That's terrible.
It was never meant to be a literal name. No one involved is quite big or tall enough to qualify.
In the words of the immortal Dr. Hook, was it Dr. Hook or was it Jay Giles' band? The pages from my mind are stripped. So, Steve... if I may call you that.
Please.
You
Mother have, does.
You created a show that is all the rage at Fringe here in Los Angeles called Too Many Hitlers. Is that the name of it?
Yes, Too Many Hitlers, or The Decoy Decameron, a title no one liked. Too highfalutin, not enough Hitler in the name.
Please tell me a title no one liked is in parentheses after that subtitle. That would be so great.
It should be. I have to admit it. I sort of compulsively tell that part of it instead of just letting it stand.
So, Too Many Hitlers.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Well, it's sort of, to not give away too much, but picture the Marx Brothers meets Downfall, with Bruno Gantz, the famous Hitler rant. Yeah, so...
But wouldn't that be... Well, first of all, that would be the Marx Brothers. But wouldn't that be like Duck Soup, then? I mean,
no, in the bunker at the end of the war.
Okay.
Downfall is a very depressing film about, yes. So it's that
says,
setting.
Says you.
Yeah, for some, it's a laugh riot. Yeah, absolutely. For some, it's a tearjerker.
But it is most famous now as the internet meme where Hitler finds out that Michael Jackson has died or something like
yes.
that.
Yes, actually, it's funny. Like 3 days before we opened, it dawned on me that, oh my God, we have to make one of those to promote the show. And we quickly pulled it together, and it's very funny. I mean, it's just a little promotional thing for it, but...
I need to see that.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's Marx
Too
Brothers...
Too Many Hitler's Rants.
Marx Brothers meets Downfall. Do multiple actors play Hitler in this?
Well, without wanting to spoil it all, it may or may not be about a bunch of decoys, Hitler decoys in the bunker at the end of the war. Yeah,
I see. At the end of the war.
Yeah.
And it's a laugh riot.
Well, some have said so.
How long is the running time?
It's about an hour.
Okay, so one act, no, or one hour without intermission.
Not without intermission,
okay.
Yeah.
And where has it been playing at Fringe? Multiple places or one venue?
No, it made its world premiere about a month ago at it's the Hollywood Fringe Fest at the Complex Theater, the Ruby
okay.
Theater there,
right.
Old Standby on Santa Monica Boulevard. And,
it got great word of mouth, great reviews, and won an award called the
Encore Award, which is an award in and of itself, but then you get extended. The theater itself funds, they say, we'll give you some more shows.
That's
please
nice.
Put on some more shows, yeah.
By the time people hear this on Monday, you will have had your last of
yes.
the Encore shows, but you maybe already have in mind a way to...
do a run? Yeah,
a run
perhaps.
Again.
I would say if they're interested, look for Too Many Hitlers on Facebook, or follow me, Steve Benequist. Steve N. Benequist is how I'm listed on there. And... And if it plays again, which it may soon, because with a cast of this size, there are several Hitlers or Hitler decoys. It would have to be soon. So yeah, people should stay tuned.
One last question before I have two questions before I let you go. One is, how do you cast your Hitler decoys? What are you looking for when you're looking to cast someone?
It's a certain effervescent je ne sais quoi, or ich weiß nicht, I believe is how you say that in Elf.
Does it really boil down to who would look funny in the mustache?
Well, so I'm in it, and it's an ensemble cast, so I needed at least one guy to look physically similar to me, and then it builds out from there, without wanting to ruin it for anyone. Caucasian, he was 56 when he died, I'm a good deal younger.
So you're stretching yourself as an actor.
Oh yeah.
All right. Cool. So what? You're still doing Big and Tall?
Yeah, I am doing Big and Tall. Big and Tall presents Bark. It's in South Pasadena at the Barclay.
Yeah, very nice place.
And I did a performance in Gary Lucy's very funny podcast. Let's Get It On. It's hilarious.
We don't plug other podcasts.
Oh, you should. Well, maybe he'd plug yours. All right. You'll just have to follow.
No, of course, no.
It's like a narrative thing. It's very different.
Yeah, very nice.
And
what was that? What did you do in that?
It's like a fake radio station, like a local radio station, and with different shows that get promos in between. But you're basically listening to a show called Let's Get It On. It's like the Love Radio. And the main guy with the silky smooth voice who does that goes missing. And I, who play Gideon Spotswood, host of Hops and Bonds, a show about craft brewing and home investment advice, clueless in love, I'm saddled with this show, playing love songs. It's a really innovative format. He plays some of the songs between... I thought it was hilarious. And I have other plays and videos coming up, so at StephenBenequist.com. People can find
excellent.
Me.
People will follow you. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Jody Orton.
How are you?
Welcome to Los Angeles.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Dean Haglund's art show at the Fine Arts Building.
I'm loving it. Absolutely loving it.
It's not bad, huh?
No.
And welcome to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And I guess also welcome to the Midweek Drive, because we'll send Alex this this audio.
We will. Yes.
How has your stay been here in Los Angeles?
Well, I've been here just over a week. So...
That tells me nothing.
No, it
you're
doesn't
ready
tell
to
you
leave.
Anything.
No,
I'm here for another 2 weeks, yeah. Not in Los Angeles, but in California.
And you went to San Diego?
Went to San Diego,
okay.
Yes.
Now all the pleasantries are behind us.
Yeah.
I heard you on the Midweek Drive this week.
Yeah.
And you were asked, and you got into a conversation about writing.
I did.
You're writing a crime novel set in Lincoln.
I am, yes.
That maybe would make a good film adaptation.
I think it would make a brilliant film adaptation.
I could direct a movie in Lincoln.
There is nobody that I would want more to direct my film than you, Phil.
So tell me about, is the book, is it contemporary crime?
Contemporary crime, yeah. It's set around a university in Lincoln. I have a lot of experience of universities in Lincoln, so I thought that might make a good and interesting setting.
So it's such a great setting because this university is as modern as any university you'll find anywhere in the world, and then just up above the hill is this ancient Roman settlement and cathedral and fortress. And so you've got the newest of the new world and the oldest of the old world with a shadow over it. What a great setting for criminal endeavors.
Exactly.
Who's the main character?
The main character is a 30-something-year-old mature student, female mature student, and one of her very good fellow mature students gets murdered.
What does mature student mean? Does
mature
that mean
basically a mature student is anybody over the age of 21.
Okay.
So they start university at 18 in the UK. Anybody, you can complete a degree within 3 years, so anyone over the age of 21 is a mature student.
Okay.
So, but, you know, that you can have people up to the age of 80 doing degrees, and I met a lot of them, you know.
All right. Nice.
Like, yeah. So.
Okay. And what is she studying? What's her...
She's studying American studies.
Okay.
Which
All
is
right.
a bit of a dying subject in the UK at the moment.
Allow me to speak on behalf of America.
If you would.
When I say, can you please take us back?
We'd be very happy to have you.
Of course, we were the
certain
we were the original
ones of you, of
we
course.
Were the original Brexit, though.
Well, yeah, you were, yeah.
So
yeah.
Okay, so getting back to the crime. So she's an American studies student, and someone she knows is mixed up with someone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, a friend of hers gets murdered. Another mature student. She decides, you know, she wants to find out who did it. Basically,
because the cops don't care.
Well, it's not that the cops don't care, but the girl who's murdered had a bit of a history.
Okay.
And they're very focused on thinking that, you know, somebody from her past did it, whereas this girl finds out throughout the book that she doesn't actually know very much about her friend and about the past that her friend had.
Okay.
So there's a bit of animosity between her and one of the detectives on the case.
Okay. All right. That sounds cool.
Does sound cool.
All right. Now, Jody, what's going on with you and broadcasting?
Broadcasting, not a great deal lately.
Why? Why is that? Do you miss it?
I do miss it, yeah. I mean, I loved being on Siren FM, on the Midweek Drive, the American Dream Team, which was the show that I co-hosted.
How's Jack Harrison doing?
I think he's doing very well. Okay. Speak to him every so often. He's seems to be working. He was working for publishers locally.
Nice.
And he's doing great. I mean, I always knew that he would do great things. So
where did you move to?
Well, I had a bit of a checkered move. I moved to London, then I moved to a place called Derby, which is in the Midlands, and now I'm living in Sheffield, which is in Yorkshire.
I may be visiting Sheffield in the new year, sometime February, March-ish.
Excellent. Well, if you're there, then give me a shout.
Yeah.
I will definitely show you around Sheffield.
I guess I'm not supposed to be talking about any of this yet, but I might be visiting you in Sheffield. That's the point.
I will keep that in mind.
Yeah. I don't look forward
to the big reveal.
I don't need any professional reason to go to the UK. It doesn't have to be about a film that I'm
in.
I'm just coming to visit friends in the UK. Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Jody, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
That it's, what is it, 17 hours, 18 hours? 18 hours.
It's supposed to be 18.
So it's been designed as an 18-hour movie.
Yeah.
And so to judge it on the pacing before you see the whole thing is hard.
Yeah.
Because maybe when it's done, you'll be like, oh, that was the perfect amount of time for Dougie to be Dougie.
Exactly.
What am I doing? Intervening? No, that's not the right word. I'm encroaching upon, infringing upon. I'm interrupting is what I'm doing. A Twin Peaks conversation. We love when Twin Peaks conversations break out at art gallery showings. We are here in downtown Los Angeles at the fantastic fine arts building, Batch Elder Tile, Lily Holloman, Batch Elder Tile. And that's Lily Holloman. Welcome to Chilpack Hollywood Hour and to Dean's Art Show.
Aloha.
And next to me, a man who's been on Chilpack Hollywood Hour before and who I have been belligerently bullying into moving into to Los Angeles for many years. And he's finally here. He's finally given in. He's finally been beaten down and has moved to Los Angeles. This is Maddie Giles. Maddie, welcome to L.A. Welcome to the Art Show. Welcome to Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Thank you for having me and inviting me to this. This is excellent.
What brings you now full time to the City of Angels?
I got a job at PBS SoCal in Century City doing their social media, which was a job I was doing out in Detroit at their PBS station, so it was kind of a lateral move, but...
Okay, now this is what... I was aware that you were doing social media work out there in Detroit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you would also, it seems to me, go to a lot of... Maybe you were just going to a lot of different events, but I feel like you were particularly covering a lot of book events. Is that true?
Yeah, so we at Detroit Public Television, we started this thing called Bookview Now, which we partnered with PBS nationally on to do a lot of book festivals. So we did book festivals in D.C., in Miami, in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago. And so that was kind of the part of the job where I got to travel and meet all these different people and all that stuff.
And you were going in order to collect materials for social media or to run social media while there?
Run social media while there. So the premise of it was that a local talent in Detroit, knows everything about books, is big into the publishing world, wanted to do a PBS show where he interviews authors about their work. And my job was to promote our live coverage of it while I was at the event.
So this is kind of amazing to be able to do that here in LA, isn't it?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, right now it's kind of up in the air as to whether the book's coverage will continue, but to be able to work at PBS SoCal is a big treat.
And you say lateral move.
Yeah.
It's a bigger market, isn't it?
It is. I mean lateral in the sense of similar job title, you know, similar responsibilities, all that kind of stuff.
Are they paying you more?
A little bit more. A little bit.
Because it costs more. You had relocation costs, right?
But, you know, PBS is nonprofit. So
well, no, it's sad. Cutting out funding, sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not allowed to comment on that impersonation at all. I don't know who I was doing. So it is. But just to know that they had a job to offer you bodes well. I mean, people are going to not let PBS go under, right? I mean,
yeah.
We need...
One would hope. We need PBS in times like these.
So you've been here all of, like, a week on the job, right?
Less than. I got in... Well, yeah, a week ago today, I got in Thursday night and then started work on Monday, so...
And is it literally like just picking up where you left off? I mean, is it the same job that you left in Detroit, or is it...
Somewhat. I mean, every PBS station has the national stuff that they air, and so I'm familiar with that, but then there's a lot of local content that I'm still learning about and stuff.
And you write. Are you still writing?
Yes, that's... So we were talking about Twin Peaks. I write reviews for... Some reviews, anyways, for the new season of Twin Peaks, Twin Peaks The Return. We've all, a couple of us on this website called The Movie Sleuth, we've been splitting the reviewing duties because everyone wanted to write about Twin Peaks, so I'm set to review this coming week's episode.
Nice. Okay. So you are still reviewing?
Yes.
And what about any fiction writing?
A little bit here and there. Nothing major. Mostly been doing reviews. But,
okay. All right. Yeah. And they... probably are happy to have you on board at Film Sleuth because of your not only your writing but also your ability in social media.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, they've asked me for pointers on getting more traction on their social media.
Well, good for you. Well, good for you. You know, one way to get you can tell them that they can get a lot of traction. A review of a movie called The Lady Killers. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. I don't know why you're laughing. And we'll check in with you again soon.
Sounds good.
Maddie, thanks. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I made a... I'm sorry I said... No, don't film me. Don't film me.
Well, our entire audience knows this man's voice because sometimes he opens the show. This is John K. Steele. John, welcome back to your Chillback Hollywood Hour, and welcome to Los Angeles and Dean's solo art show.
What a show.
It's...
oh, my God. What I love about the whole show is the fact it's like... when I come to downtown L.A., every time I do it, I'm... moved by the fact that, you know, like 30, 40 years ago, it was a sort of dump. But, you know, the point is, this is the original Los Angeles. You know, 100 years ago, 90 years ago, this is where everybody who was in the film business lived. And these buildings are so ornate and so beautiful. And, you know, then Hollywood, this is before Hollywood. This is the original Los Angeles.
Long before there was anything else around downtown, there was a million people a day on these streets in the 1910s. And you've witnessed in the years you've been coming here, it coming back to life, it being restored, it being redeemed in many ways. And what do you think the art, Dean's art?
Two things I've got to say about that, which I think is amazing. Thank God they didn't knock it down. It's still there. I mean, can you imagine if this cleared all out? It's still there, and now it's preserved. And what Dean Hagman's done in drawing it is fantastic. It's beautifully done. It's like this fantastic watercolors. It looks like this beautiful romantic idea of the time.
Exactly. It's both of the time. It captures not only the building but the time and what it might have been like. I mean, this one he just finished over here with the clock tower.
Yeah.
That sky
where he lives
around it. Oh my goodness.
My God. Dean Hagman is really, really captured the romantic time of the 20s, the 30s, and he really has. It's absolutely beautiful. His work is beautiful. He's a great artist. And when you stand in those buildings, I can't believe, I mean, I come from Britain, and we know about old buildings. When you walk into these foyers and you pass these buildings, you go, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Do you know the Powell Pressburger movie, Matter of Life and Death, David Niven?
Yes.
There, some of these buildings feel like escape that might have come out of one of their fantasy films, which were, you know, England, 1940s.
It's like I'm back in time. It's like, it's just incredible. People say to me in London, when I'm going to LA, what are they there for? It's got no history. Are you joking, I say? The whole history of the movie industry is there. And then beyond that, you've got the whole history of a place called Downtown, which has got such a fantastic, condensed, beautiful Art Deco history that people just don't know about it.
Also, people really don't understand how much American political history is based here. Our whole oil industry, people think Texas, they think Houston, but they all lived here. Mm-hmm. This is really where the oil industry of the 20th
century
began.
Is that right? Yeah. Yes. I didn't know that. Yeah.
But the other thing about it is Los Angeles has a very unique history in that it was a history written by so many people who were coming here to start over and to create new identities. And what a unique history that is, right? People literally, and it still happens, people come here and what's the first thing they do? Change their name. They start a whole new history for themselves. And that to me is fascinating, right? The place where we get to start over. In some ways, will you tell me a little bit about this show that you did at the National, the play where you did the Connecticut accent?
Oh, God. Stop! I was working at the National Theatre. I had a Connecticut accent. It's a new play by David Herrick called The Red Barn. Not the Red Barn as in the German fighter pilot, but The Red Barn as a great big shed in your garden. Yeah. Yeah. It was fantastic. It was a complete sellout. We were told by the artistic director of the whole National Theatre, it could have run for years. But unfortunately, we only ran for 4.5 months because that was what we were scheduled for, right. And the next play took over.
And why did you have to do a Connecticut accent? You were playing.
It was all set in Connecticut, and all the characters were set in Connecticut, and it was based on a story around that area, and so that's what we had to do.
Who did you play?
I played a lead role as a character who. I can't remember the character's name.
Okay, that's right.
Could you edit this? Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
We don't, but we could.
Yeah. I can't remember the character's name, actually. But yeah.
The 4.5 months are over. You don't need to remember anymore. Screw it.
It's a murder mystery.
Oh,
it's a murder mystery.
Okay, cool.
Somebody dies in the story, and it's like a kind of who did it sort of thing. But
Did you do it?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
It turned out he died of natural.
He dies of natural causes.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Okay.
There's no murder.
Spoiler alert.
There's no murder.
Spoiler alert.
Oh no.
Yeah. I guess it wouldn't be able to.
Please edit
yours now.
Please edit this.
I might edit that part out. All right. Thanks, John. Welcome.
I'm going down to where I heard it.
First floor, yeah. There's R and there's one.
As you can hear, the party at Dean Haglund's solo art show is raging. Okay. It is in full swing, full effect.
You're bringing the roof down.
Aaron Petrulis, our one-time youngest listener, is now our listener most dancing atop a table.
Yes!
Exactly.
That's going to happen.
You do realize, Aaron Petrulis, your dad listens to this show. So.
He loves it.
Yeah, he loves the show.
He's
and
the most supportive person in the world.
And behave is what I'm saying. By the time Bob hears this show, he will know that you wore the alien skirt. That you wore the first night you met Dean Haglund 10 years ago, summer of 2007, in Sheffield. Am I correct?
It wasn't in Sheffield. It was outside of Sheffield.
It was outside of Sheffield.
Yeah, okay.
Your tour was like in random cities.
It really was. I had a tour group. They were my producers in London, and they would send me a train ticket, and I would go, and there'd be this random theater somewhere in the UK, anywhere, and I would do a show, and then they'd have a little hotel for me.
Aww.
And then the next morning I'd take the train back to London.
How
it was
romantic.
the weirdest tour.
And that came out of your Fringe Festival experience.
Fringe Festival,
right?
Experience in Edinburgh, yeah. I met these guys and they said, yeah, we'll send you around the UK and
well,
Ireland.
So Fringe Festival was 2007. So, yeah. And that was summer. So then how long after that was the tour? Because that's when you would have met. You were listening to the show already. You may have already, I don't know, reviewed Karl Rove,
like,
I Love
season
You.
One.
Yeah.
Season one. Yeah. Season one. Yeah. That's
back when they were like 30 minutes long.
Wasn't
and you
there
guys didn't have a theme song.
And it was a different actor who played Dean.
Yeah,
it was.
I had a much more entertaining guy
still
playing me.
Hair.
Yeah.
When Dean left for Fringe Fest, Dick Sargent replaced
Dick Sargent, yeah. And then Nick York played me.
It was luscious.
But it was a different name of the show.
That's right.
Yeah,
back
and
then.
Y'all got sued.
And we all, yeah. A cease and desist.
Sony Pictures,
Hollywood.
Chill Pack Comedy Hour.
We should never have said Sony Pictures. I don't know why we thought that. That's a good idea. That was a stupid title.
And you could never say the intro to the show right.
Why? Oh, yeah, I never did. I still don't.
Well, you don't have to anymore.
I don't have to anymore.
Yeah, he moved to another continent to be able to avoid
trying to enter the show.
Goddamn historic building we were in. Now, speaking of which, we actually are not anymore at the historic building where your solo show took place tonight, and where people can see the art for the rest of the month,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the rest of the month, yeah. You can go to the Fine Arts Building, 811 West 7th in downtown Los Angeles.
You know what? Go for the building and stay for the art.
Yes, exactly.
Because the building...
Why can't it be the other way around?
No, well, because...
They want to see his art.
No, because they don't want you to... If you don't actually lease a space in the building, they don't want you to stay for the building.
Don't
you see what I'm saying?
Don't stay for the building unless you're leasing a place there.
So, that was Steve Benequist.
Yes,
and, and when you wonder why something abruptly got cut out...
But you'll leave yourself in saying that was...
of course. And now we are at the historic Ace Hotel.
Ace Hotel, the United Artists Building. Mary Pickford's grand... not illusion, but a celebration of Spanish cathedral art and arts in general.
A jubilee.
A jubilee of architectural wonder and... How to circumvent LA's 12-story limit by putting a 3-story false pinnacle that is hollow so she could have the tallest building in Los Angeles.
Well,
so that whole thing exists because Mary Pickford wanted the tallest building in Los Angeles.
We are at the rooftop bar
For those of you who are
Ace
wondering.
Hotel,
yeah.
United Artists Building.
And find us on Google Earth.
Right.
I would
Please.
Say a three-story falsy is about the biggest I could imagine, frankly. That's Mary
three
Pickford.
Three-story falsy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I know Mary Pickford's next biography.
that might be the name of the phony silent film we make.
Oh, three-story falsy.
We are doing... So we are, actually. We're... In October, as a fundraiser for the club, we're putting on another variety show,
uh-huh.
and we're setting it in 1933 for the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, which would be in its eighth year, and we're billing it as the final vaudeville show.
Oh.
And so it'll be a vaudeville show simulcast on radio, and
great
as
idea.
Part of it,
really
Aaron will be doing something that is silent film related.
Love it.
Yeah.
But
so,
as Mary Pickford?
No.
Oh,
no.
Right.
But as...
Silent film related. That's all I need to hear.
Yeah.
And when is that going to take place?
That's October 22nd, right? Sunday, October 22nd in Los Angeles.
You're going to come in town?
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm in Cambodia.
Oh.
Yeah, that's going to be
I'm
tough.
In Cambodia.
All right.
On purpose?
So, yeah, I'm painting. I'm on a painting tour. Artists get together and they fly and they have a tour guide and they take them to locations to paint. So it's like
in
50
front of huge audiences.
No,
I can't hear you.
I can't hear you paint.
That's you to the audience. It's like a stadium. You said it's a tour. I was kind of picturing.
I love how he automatically thought that the audience didn't like what he was doing.
Yeah, I know. Like, how fast I took that.
Paint funnier, monkey boy.
I'm so used to that.
Wind. We're getting a lot of wind right now.
I used to have that wind sock on this
thank
thing.
You.
All right.
Hey,
whoa.
Doritos and guacamole.
That's not a bad call.
That's a good
we
call.
We like that.
Right there.
For those of you at home, feel free to sample the Doritos. And okay, so how'd you feel about the opening?
I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought I got lots of compliments. There was some very influential artists, including the famous New York photographer who came in. I don't know, but there's a documentary on her life being shown this week here in L.A. She was flown from New York for this documentary.
Wow.
I didn't catch her full name, but she insisted on me taking her from painting to painting and giving her a description.
I saw that woman.
Yeah.
She was a serious woman.
She was a serious... This is a serious New York artist that came there, and I think we really communed.
So we got to find out who this woman is, this New York photographer.
Do I have to find this out now?
No, but we'll have to research this.
Yeah.
And so it was many works that are in your book,
yep.
which is called...
The... Technically, it's called The Illustrated Walking Tour of Broadway Downtown Los Angeles.
And people can get it where? On your website?
Yeah, deanhaglund.com. Or if you're in L.A., go to 850 Broadway, South Broadway, to Il Cafe, the most delicious coffee you'll have anywhere in downtown L.A. And they have copies of the book there for sale.
So come and see your art at
yep.
the Fine Arts Building.
Yep.
Anytime... I think it's open, what? It's open 8 to 8 or something,
yeah.
I think, there.
And,
the fine
and
arts
in fact,
building.
Not to encourage everybody, but one time I was jogging with my dogs at 4:30 in the morning, and I went into that theater, and the security guard, the night security guard, turned on the lights so I could see the show at 4:30 in the morning.
Wow.
With my two dogs.
Yeah.
So it's actually open 24 hours.
But your TV's Dean Haglund, and they are not. So that they might have to wait for business hours.
I assume the Doberman scared them.
No, that could be true, too.
Yeah.
So bring your Dobermans,
yeah.
and you'll be allowed to see the art.
Anytime, any 24 hours a day.
All right. Well, congratulations. It was
Thank
very
you so
exciting.
Much.
It was so fun to see the paintings that are in the book, but equally as much fun to see the works that are not in the book.
Right.
And
the ones, yeah.
I don't want to spoil what I wrote about in your little guest book.
Oh, I want to see that.
But would it surprise you that the word romantic was used to describe your art?
It would be, actually. Well, but not because I realized living in Australia how much, not only I miss L.A., but how much I love L.A. And I didn't realize, you know, how deeply both of us... Not you and me, Patty and I, really, really are engaged in downtown Los Angeles and how much we love it.
Right.
And you hear so many people go, oh, LA's bullshit, blah, blah, blah. Matt LaDunge being one of them. and yet, being in Sydney, and there's so many similarities between Sydney and Los Angeles.
Right.
And yet we love it so much here.
Well, it made me go back through my memory to other themes in your work, and I actually find that the word romantic applies to them as well.
Oh, I'm a romantic.
That you gravitate towards works that, I don't know, they evoke this... I actually said this to John K. Steele when we were looking at the paintings. I asked him, Lily and I have been watching one of my favorite Powell and Pressburger movies from the UK, Matter of Life and Death, starring David Niven and Kim Hunter and Raymond Massey. And it's this wonderful, reverse Wizard of Oz Technicolor piece where, you know, it's pre-script Technicolor and then it's desaturated Technicolor for heaven. But the whole movie is this really colorful, lush fantasy dream about some kind of dark themes and serious themes, world at war and the animosity that was taking place, believe it or not, at the end of World War II between England and America. And so real stuff. But it evoked this really romantic kind of dreamlike quality that I think your work would be right at home with. The stuff that makes up our dreams, not the fantasies that we could pick for ourselves.
Right.
Not that kind of thing, but the pop cultural imagery or the nightmare imagery. Of childhood, but looking at this through this kind of romantic lens of these things, even the disturbing, even the nightmarish, are uniquely us and what makes us us.
Well, and it's funny because the City Hall painting, I had painted as an idea of sunset. So that often when the sun sets on City Hall, because it's a white building, it often glows blue in the shadow and golden, yellow, orange on the sun side. And so that was my idea of painting that thing. But I realized I painted it in reverse, as if the sun is setting actually in the north as opposed to setting in the west. And so the sun is actually hitting the wrong side of the building. And that is kind of like this dreamscape. I realized only afterwards when I was here going, oh yeah, the sun actually hits Santa Monica. So if it ever lit like that, all of LA had to be... have no other buildings in it. It would only be Los Angeles City Hall being standing.
For it to have that.
Yeah. And so you realize, well, that's a dreamscape in itself. To only have City Hall standing is like sort of like this.
But when you do romanticize places, and if you romanticize locations, you don't romanticize that building as being surrounded by or pressed against other buildings.
Right.
You think of it
separate and holding
separate.
Under, like an island unto itself.
Yeah.
And so that's how City Hall is.
Now, what about the colors on the painting you finished this week of the Tower Theater?
Right. So the sunsets often here in Los Angeles are amazing. And there's been a couple times where the sky has gone red. If there's like a low cloud and the sun hits it and the marine layer comes in, then that sunset will light up the sky in a fantastic fuchsia magenta orange color. And so I have painted the Tower Theater without its steeple, with the clock. The clock at the Tower Theater says Tower Theater in it, and the fonts are unique because Tower is on the top between 9 and 6, so those letters are upright, and then Theater is between the bottom, right?
Right, so it's upside down.
Upside down, but they have to put the font. So if you're looking at it, all the letters are vertical, but when the R and the T and the R of Tower and Theater match, they're actually on opposite ends. So it's this weird V
visual shift that goes on.
Right.
So painting that and pointing that out and giving that the focus with a magenta sky and the building itself in this, the terracotta is sort of a faded yellow right. on that. Given that the yellow, the blue, the sign, and the magenta, those are your three primaries. To me, the Tower Theater is such a primary example of architecture.
So
and primary colors.
This is fascinating, this approach to downtown Los Angeles. A place that was in its original heyday, in, of course, the 1910s, 1920s, and captured in so many films that people love, in black and white.
Right.
And by the time they are photographed in color, they're in disrepair.
Yeah.
It's to show urban decay, to show the
Omega
loss
Man.
Of
yeah,
the urban like, dream.
And that time in the, you know, 67, yeah.
And the color of the buildings, not the film, the color of the buildings is now desaturated, almost like it was pristine in black and white, and now it's desaturated in color.
I point you to even Mary Pickford's Pinnacle here at the Ace Hotel. Before the restoration, that was almost black with soot and rust and everything. It had a patina on it that did not highlight this terracotta yellow that you see now when you look up at it. And the restoration brought it back to this sort of original, what do you call that, a yellowish beige, a warm, creamy
topaz. There's so many warm, almost golden hues.
Golden.
And this is the thing that really catches me about seeing it in the gallery is, right, in its heyday, to visualize what it was like in its heyday is to visualize how colorful it was. Because when we think of it, or when I think of it, I think of what I've seen in black and white, and not what it would be like to walk here, to live here. And this is the depth of your connection that you're talking about living here as a living, breathing place. It's how colorful this place was and how colorful it's again becoming.
Well, and this is the whole thing, even about neon signs.
Yeah.
So we go to Claude Neon, who is a French inventor and chemist, and he had captured the neon gas in a tube, electrified it, and realized this is a great way to make signs. That was 1922. By 1923, the first neon sign was just over here on Olympic Boulevard at the Packard Car Factory. And they put a sign up, said the Packard car selling for $1,250.
Wow.
In neon.
Whoa. And it stopped traffic. People would stop.
Wow.
And it was dubbed liquid fire because it was so bright. Even during the day, you saw these signs. And you think about signage back then, you know, as much as they billboards and sign painters. This was the first that would like electrically lit neon tubes, and that Packard building had everybody driving from all over Los Angeles and Hollywood and Beverly Hills. They came downtown to see this neon sign.
Wow.
That was 1923.
They committed to that price because neon's
yeah,
pretty
I know.
Hard to make.
It's pretty hard to like go, oh, we're up $5.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, when we saw this presentation on the history of neon art, you jump ahead a few decades, so many of the signs. And like even now, we heard Los Angeles is losing one neon sign a week.
Yeah.
One neon, and it's just being, and so the good people at the Museum of Neon Art are trying to
save
as many of these as possible. They have warehouses, but they're out of space in terms of where to save
where
these, let alone to restore them. But think about when the exchanges, and we heard about this in a presentation, when the telephone exchanges changed, because everything used to be El Dorado 777.
Right.
So many of these designed lit-up signs had the phone number in it. And then when it went from the local exchanges, Broadway 648,
get rid of that sign.
The sign was done.
Done.
So think about how many were.
Well, Pennsylvania, 65,000.
This is an interesting thing that we've never talked about before. I love that even the signage, the lettering, the advertising, yeah, that this is being celebrated as art, not yes, just as marketing tools, and not just as craft. We understand a great amount of craftsmanship goes into creating these tubes. The one over that you knew about over in Clifton's, yeah, that tube that is still lit.
77 years now?
Long. It's got to be longer than that, right? It's got to be 80, I would think. But it's the longest continuously burning neon tube. I want somebody to find out who did that neon work. I'm serious. Go track down their kids, their grandkids, and let them know your dad, your grandfather, whoever it was, is the best that ever did this. Because neon could burn forever. The gas doesn't expire. It's a vacuum.
Right. It's in a vacuum. It's the glass itself. And the glass leaks.
What makes it leak, what makes it quote-unquote burn out, is imperfections in how the vacuum tube is made.
Right.
So this guy...
Made a perfect tube.
And, I mean, wouldn't you want to know that? Like, if you were his grandkids, wouldn't you want to know? Well, our granddad did this thing better than anyone else has ever done it.
There's also an Edison light bulb in Fort Myers, Florida, because Edison and Henry Ford had summer homes there. And there's a light bulb he created that has a bamboo filament that's still burning. It's 7 watts, but he made a perfect vacuum and a thick glass. And then they realized, and Henry Ford told them about planned obsolescence.
Speaking of Edison, did you hear this is apparently true. It may be apocryphal, but I've heard that it's true, that in an interview, Albert Einstein was asked, how does it feel to be the smartest man in the world? And he said, I don't know, you'd have to ask Tesla. But what I wanted to ask was this. So if we can agree that neon is it's art, it's a work of art, even if it was designed for advertising purposes, like this sign that
right,
you... What's the fire called?
Liquid fire.
Liquid fire, the liquid fire sign. Okay. Because there's a couple signs in your show.
Yeah.
Where you've painted signs. I'm particularly struck by the prayer changes things. But I don't want to get into that too much because I continue to give away what I wrote in your book.
Okay.
But you're creating works of art that are capturing what are basically slogans or advertising signs.
Right.
Do you find that there's innate artistry in those signs?
Yeah, for sure. But it's also in the context of how we live, right? So the prayer changes things is ironic now because the rust and entropy has changed the sign. So it's not just prayer changes things, entropy changes things.
Well, and yet, see, this is why I guess I was surprised to realize how much romanticism, not capital R probably, but romanticism runs through your work, because it's not rust or entropy I see in your painting of the prayer changes things. What I see is almost that it's fading away.
It's ghost-like.
It's fading away. It's ghost-like.
Like, yeah,
it's like this idea has almost left us.
Absolutely.
Never mind the sign. The idea that prayer can change anything.
Right. That just this simple act.
Has faded. Faded from memory. And so it's not about rust. It's not about entropy. It's not about modernization versus any. It's wistful to me.
Yeah.
In a way that surprised me coming from you. I mean, I don't, you know. But isn't that interesting? Because
yeah, right,
we don't...
I'm not that wistful.
Well, no, but I mean, I guess it's like with me, I don't set out to make the movies that I want to see. I set out to make the movies that are me to make them.
Right.
And they're going to reveal themselves to me. They're going to reveal to me who I am.
Yeah, for sure.
Rather than picking...
And that's the same thing with paintings, too. You never go out... You know, your idea of what you're going to paint changes as you paint it.
Yeah.
So and as the subject and your relationship to the subject.
So you see this rusted entropy, but that's not what comes through. What comes through is this kind of wistfulness of an idea that no longer has a place in...
And that's how it plays in so many levels. That's the whole...
Yeah.
I mean, that seeing that sign in itself plays on all those levels just as you stand there in front of it.
But it is an unconscious... And unless and when you start to I mean, I guess you could sit there and you could have the conversation about, okay, let's talk about all the levels this is playing on. But when you engage the creative I want to express what this experience is for me through a creative process, now you're tapping into your own unconscious and you're finding out ways that it's playing upon you that you didn't know.
And now you're making me think David Lynch is actually
And this is where I was getting to.
Really?
Because, you know, another thing you have in common is the championing of advertising as art form.
I damn you, David Lynch. You are everything.
I love it. And I love that you knew I was getting there before I even got there. I had back-channeled you on this. So, I mean, it was, oh boy, I thought it was really subtle the way I was getting there.
It suddenly just reverberated. Like, oh, fuck, I'm David Lynch. I'm David Lynch.
All right.
I hate that guy.
Next up, Forest Lawn. Congratulations, Dean Haglund.
Thank you so much.
Celebrity deaths.
Lily Holloman, welcome back to your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and welcome back to Paramount Ranch.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
On the show or at Paramount Ranch?
Both.
Now, we just finished our picnic following our hike, our 30-minute hike. We always come out here a couple times a year and hike and enjoy silent films as part of Silence Under the Stars, put on by Hollywood Heritage and Paramount Ranch.
It's very exciting.
This is the 30th anniversary screening of Silence Under the Stars here, and they're celebrating with 1926's Beau Geste, which was in fact filmed in part here at Paramount Ranch. So many movies filmed here, and even after it became a national park, it continued to be a location for filmmaking. The Old West Town from Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman is still standing, which was seen not too long ago in the Western film Bone Tomahawk, and of course last year in HBO's Westworld.
Yes, the big climax of the entire series takes place on this very ranch.
Very cool, in the Old West section. Also, this is a location that's very beloved by the X-Files, by fans of the show. I think it's the location where William is born, where Scully's son is born.
Oh, that's exciting.
I'm not sure, but it's a location that I know X-Files fans from all over come and make pilgrimages to. And speaking of the X-Files, it's your sad duty to speak to the late-breaking celebrity death that we have to address. Word just came to us that the Oscar-winning actor Martin Landau, dead at age 89, of course, a fantastic supporting turn in the first X-Files big screen movie, Fight the Future, but an Oscar winner for, I believe, Ed Wood, and an Oscar nominee for Crimes and Misdemeanors, Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors. Such a great performance in that. In fact, I think it was Crimes and Misdemeanors that really jump-started his big screen career, which had begun, I think, in the 1950s for the likes of Hitchcock in North by Northwest. So there's a man who was working regularly for 70 damn years.
But what kills me about celebrity deaths like this is, what was the last thing we saw him in? I mean, I know he had a good long run, but I wish we had just seen him in something.
I think it wasn't that long ago. There was a very good indie that he did, and unfortunately we're out here at Paramount Ranch. We're out here without our laptops, without our ability to look this stuff up, so we're going off the cuff. But he had an indie. I'll try to find out for next week, but I do recall that we went to see something with him, and I think it was a very romantic film. Of course, as a kid, he was a big deal to me and my friends because he starred on Space, first on Mission Impossible, and then when he left Mission Impossible, he came back to television with his wife, Barbara Bain, on a science fiction show, one of the worst science fiction shows of all time, and we loved it, Space 1999. Where the moon breaks away from the orbit of the Earth.
Oh, wow. That sounds scary.
Yeah, it was kind of scary. It was good. So Martin Landau. And this is on the same day that at age 77, groundbreaking filmmaker George A. Romero died today. Night of the Living Dead on, I believe, both Dean and mine. I know it was on mine, but I believe on both of our lists of top 10 horror films of all time, the original 1960s black and white Night of the Living Dead. Did you ever see that?
I did not, nor did I see the Nicole Kidman remake.
Was she in the remake, Night of the Living Dead?
Or was it that, or was... No, that was an alien something, rather, that she...
You're
did.
Thinking of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yes.
Yeah, she did a one of the many remakes of that. Well, you've really contributed a lot to the memories of George
Listen,
Romero.
Listen, I don't know anything about zombies. I'm sorry. It's a weakness, or...
Can I open a soda? I literally just...
Hollywood Heritage's John Girodo just showed up. He has to open a soda. Perhaps the soda he'll be opening is from Pop Soda Shop off Route 66 in rural Oklahoma. It's triple X pure cane sugar root beer.
That's very important. Pure cane sugar is very important.
Since 1895.
Not even a real sugar. Oh, my God. You guys, thank you very much. This is from the actual road trip.
Pop Soda Shop, one of the most prestigious destinations for Route 66 explorers. There's a gigantic, wow. The world's largest soda pop bottle is outside the shop.
So you've added to my bucket list.
We, of course, a little tiny token of our affection and appreciation for helping look after Fuzz Aldrin. But now, lightning round, George Romero died today.
And Martin Landau.
So when I ask you memories of George Romero... George Romero's getting really short shrift on this show or whatever. Lily says that she brags that she knows nothing of Night of the Living Dead except that Nicole Kidman starred in a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That's her knowledge of Night of the Living Dead. I ask you thoughts about George Romero, and you play the Martin Landau card.
Only because it's what last came up on the internet as I just arrived.
While you were driving.
But actually, I was very happy to see that the two most important things for me as a filmmaker and growing up were represented. The IndieWire article was immediately on, oh my God, Night, what is Romero's, The Motorcycle Nights.
The Motorcycle Nights.
I'm trying to think of the name of the film. His third film, his breakout film after Dawn of the Dead, he did no business. It's Ed Harris's first starring role. Oh. Everyone, it's a Renaissance traveling fair, and they are knights of the round table, but they ride motorcycles and they do jousting tournaments. And you're not with me on this, so why did you debase me on my George Romero thing?
It was, I know this.
So anyways, they represented that in an article, and that was really important to me as a kid. I obviously didn't know the title, but you would see it on cable rotation, and you're just like, what the heck's going on? These guys ride motorcycles, but they're jousting, and they're like, anyways, cool. And then Martin Landau, of course, Ed Wood and his Academy Award for that, but I just recently saw that, I think it was at the New Bev or Cine Family, and so it was wonderful to have just experienced that, and so it wasn't a bad moment when I heard about his passing. It was a moment of love and appreciation for both of them.
And as I was saying, I mean, Martin Landau's career, 70 years almost, I mean, certainly 60-something years it lasts, because I not a week goes by I don't think about him in North by Northwest, for crying out loud. And
he's certainly one of those actors where you can appreciate it as a father and son, too, or father and daughter, or mother and daughter, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm just saying, there's so many films that he was in that I can think of that my dad introduces me to. You know, we're watching Mission Impossible, so I'm seeing his face. Or North by Northwest, my dad is showing me. But then he's later coming up in things, like I said, Ed Wood.
I thought that this
can
is what it was called.
Like I said five more times?
It's Knight Riders, and I didn't want to call it Knight Riders. Knight with a K, of course, Knight Riders. And I didn't want to call it that because I was going, well, wait, there was Knight Rider. That's what I'm thinking of. But so, yeah, I remember that. That's a very good call. Of course, now you're going to have to tell me, which one was George Romero's undead movie that's in the shopping mall? Because that's the other real masterpiece.
That's the one, yeah, that was also an experience in childhood. That's Dawn of the Dead. So that's Dawn the second of the Dead. One.
Oh, I thought that was the third one, no?
Day of the Dead would be the third one.
Wow, you know your stuff.
Well, you know, because they were like a really weird kind of in-between film. It wasn't a horror film. I didn't like horror films. I didn't like Friday the 13th, things like that. And I wasn't necessarily a zombie freak or anything, but there was something about the survivalist element, the element of...
And the racial politics of Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, wow.
Still hold, still pack a wallop, still relevant. And then the social satire politics of Dawn of the Dead, where we learn that zombies can't navigate escalators, and that's an important important piece. If you want to get away from a zombie, go up the escalator.
And what's more important for Romero is the fact that he's coming from an independent world, and these films are impacting us because they feel weird to us. They're unnatural. They're not big stars. They're low budget. But I didn't know what that meant as a kid. So they're coming from his hometown and his home crew, and so they had this little special quality that people, I guess, look at as quote unquote low budget. But I think it had a feeling of like making them real. Like, is this a documentary? Is this?
And what's special to you about being here at Paramount Ranch?
Well, you know what? What's special to me is that you have spread the word on this place and that you're a repeat visitor. I didn't think, you know, there's not many people that can take the leap of faith to understand that this is going to be a fun experience, whether you're a film geek or whether you're a historian, et cetera, et cetera. It's not about that. It's the live music. It's being outdoors. It's being with a bunch of people. It's experiencing a film that is always good. It's always a crowd pleaser by selection by the amazing Randy Haberkamp.
That's who does the accompaniment.
Yes.
Free of sheet music, right?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Randy Haberkamp is the programmer.
Oh.
Michael Mortillo is the on the piano keys.
Okay. Yeah, does the live accompaniment to the 16-millimeter projection out here.
Yes. Randy Haberkamp is the head of Silent Society, which is one of the committees of Hollywood Heritage, and he's been doing it for, I believe, this is the 30th anniversary, 30th year of Silent Society.
This is the 30th anniversary, yeah.
Which is pretty amazing.
All right, John Giroto, thanks. What an exciting episode of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and it ends with a little silent accompaniment.
Of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.